Welcome to 40 A&M in 5, a download of 40 A&M LLC, recorded at 1800 Eastern on Sunday, September 29th. I'm Chris Bohm, and this is our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, UK Deputy Prime Minister Nicholas Clegg joins with two US senators to talk up the TTIP in Washington, D.C. RSA, the internet security firm, issues a warning regarding a possible encryption flaw. California Bill SB 568, giving minors a right to remove their online content, is signed into law. An advisory blog from the Platform for Good gives helpful advice to explain online bullying to children. Google is reportedly thinking of tossing its cookies. How may it now track users' online advertising preferences? The Federal Reserve is looking into how $600 million changed hands in faster than the speed of light. Four LinkedIn users take it to court in California, and unfortunately for it, the same week that the firm releases its twice-yearly transparency report. Pandora revamps its iPad app and branding, and also scores a legal victory in New York's Southern District, but more litigation is ahead. And we finish out today with our roundup of select international calendar events for the coming week. But first, a number of news outlets are reporting on Popular Science magazine's decision of last Wednesday to end the open forum for comments at the bottom of their online articles. Citing the prevalence of trolls and spam bot comments, they've decided that the comment option could actually be bad for science. Popular Science cited research from a study by the University of Wisconsin-Madison professor Dominique Broussard, who argues that exposure to bad comments, when so many are not legitimate commentary but ad hominem attacks and irrelevant rants dropped on their site, can skew a reader's opinion of the legitimate post itself. Professor Broussard said to the New York Times that, as commenters shape public opinion shapes public policy. Public policy shapes how and whether and what research gets funded. You can start to feel compelled to hit the off switch in a situation like this. Statistics suggest that commenters on Popular Science's site, like other large sites with the comment option, represent only about 1% of those who actually read the online piece. The Guardian reports that YouTube has decided to shake things up with their comment form as well. Comments on YouTube will now need to be tied to a commenter's Google Plus profile, which you will need to log into in order to comment. As a Google user, you will see posts from your friends and acquaintances and popular personalities, with random passerby comments relegated further down the comments list. In a similar vein, the Huffington Post will begin this month asking commenters to create an account and verify their identity before making a comment post. Jimmy Soney, the Huffington Post's managing editor, told The Guardian, "We are capable of doing far worse things to one another when we do not have to own up to the things that we do." On Tuesday, September 24th, the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. hosted UK Deputy Prime Minister Nicholas Clegg and U.S. Senators Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, and Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, for an in-depth conversation about the potential Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. The event was part of a significant report launch of TTIP in the 50 states, Jobs and Growth from Coast to Coast, which was written in partnership with the British Embassy in Washington and the Bertelsmann Foundation. According to the report, across the U.S., nearly 750,000 jobs would be added to the economy due to the increased trade with Europe alone. Each state would also send 33% more exports to the EU annually, on average. And importantly, according to the Atlantic Council, the TTIP would also be a key driver of future wealth, as each American family would be estimated to gain an additional $865 annually due to the lower costs of goods and increased wages associated with export jobs. As stated by UK Deputy Prime Minister Clegg, our two economies represent roughly half of world GDP, and trade between the EU and the US represents about a third of global trade. Moreover, passage of a TTIP would demonstrate the commitment of the EU and US to free markets, the rule of law, and strong protections of intellectual property rights. According to the Atlantic Council release on the event, Senators Murphy and Johnson respectively each made the case for TTIP on the local level, noting that their states of Connecticut and Wisconsin stand to gain 10,000 and 14,000 jobs, respectively. According to the New York Times, companies from an array of industries have made their wish lists for TTIP known. That being said, according to the Times, when corporate delegations make the pilgrimage to Capitol Hill to talk up the TTIP and benefits of trade and jobs, it has, in the words of one lobbyist, been very hard to engage lawmakers on this issue. This may be one of the key reasons why the UK's Deputy Prime Minister would join forces with two US senators to help promote the negotiations. Whatever your position may be on some of the more controversial issues at potential stake for the TTIP, such as the notion of an investor state appeals resolution system, eliminating tariffs on chicken, or harmonizing on healthcare R&D regulatory issues, the talks will not likely be able to tackle substantial or difficult challenges without there seeming to be high-level legislative interests on both sides of the Atlantic. More on this to come in the coming weeks. Early in September, it was reported that, as part of the revelations made by Edward Snowden regarding U.S. surveillance tactics, the NSA had been hard at work to foil basic encryption and other safeguards on the web. These efforts, which according to the New York Times fell under the rubric of programs called Bull Run, Manassas, and SIGINT, have included supercomputers and technical expertise deployed at massive scales in order to break encryption algorithms. But they also have reportedly involved the seeding of international standards bodies by the NSA of backdoors or weaknesses in budding new encryption standards. While the New York Times and other reports in early September brought some of these details to light, on Monday of last week, RSA, the internet security firm, echoed a warning made by the Department of Commerce's National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, advising its customers not to use a particular encryption algorithm. The advisories from RSA and NIST come, according to the BBC, in the wake of a belief that an encryption algorithm known as dual elliptic curve deterministic random bit generation may have an intentionally introduced flaw, which could make the standard not only unlockable by the NSA, but potentially subject to hack by others. Last week, we reported on two stories covered by the New York Times and NPR, respectively, each of which address issues around the protection of children online. There are some new developments on these stories this week. On Tuesday, September 24th, California Governor Jerry Brown signed SB 568, sponsored by California State Senator Daryl Steinberg. This bill, now law, will compel online companies and app developers to give minors, defined as anyone younger than 18 years old, the ability to remove any of their online content. The law also says that it's acceptable for a website to allow minor users the ability to file a request for content deletion. If your website is accessible by any California resident, you will need to ensure that it's abiding by this new law, which will take effect on January 1, 2015, to give companies some time to ramp up compliance measures. Apart from the new law, California is also considering legislation to require websites to spell out what they do when they received do not track requests from users, requests that are often implemented via choices that a user makes in their browser settings. Complying with the bill, AB 370, if it's enacted, may require something as simple as we do not honor them from a website, but the bill's authors see it as a small step forward. A second story focused on the issue of the impact of online behavior on children, particularly bullying. The Family Online Safety Institute posted a link to an excellent February 2013 blog article by Trudy Ludwig of the platformforgood.org, which gives guidance to help your child understand what bullying is and what it isn't. The blog says that when a child is mean to multiple people or posts a hurtful comment online that can be reviewed by many, he or she is creating a repeated pattern of meanness, which can cross the line into bullying. Ms. Ludwig does go on to say that those who bully often lack empathy, the ability to know what it feels like to be in someone else's shoes and to have compassion for pain and suffering from their actions. What the blog article doesn't attempt to cover, but which other pieces this week have touched upon, including comments from the Huffington Post to The Guardian, is that we are capable of doing far worse things to each other when we do not have to own up to the things that we do. Gang-style social exclusion, which, unlike on the playground, can often be executed online without giving the target child the benefit of being able to express his or her objection to the organizer or bully, can be just as, if not more, difficult for the victim to overcome. Trudy Ludwig's core advice is critical to parents, which is to remind your child that every person has value. While we all may not agree with each other's opinions, While we may not end up being friends, we all deserve to have our presence acknowledged and to be treated in a civil and respectful manner. This is a key component to what being good online and being a good online citizen is all about. Ms. Ludwig's blog article can be found at aplatformforgood.org. Several news outlets last week commented on Google's reported efforts to find an alternative to cookies, those tiny tracking packets that are left with computers when you browse nearly any website. Many people use their browsers to either turn off these or block them. Some browsers, such as Firefox, come with the default setting to have these cookies turned off, and smartphone browsers and apps don't use them at all. Of course, all of this blocking and turn-off means that fewer people see relevant online ads, which means lower revenue for many. One alternative concept being explored and reportedly one of interest to Google is to treat user online habits, profiles, and machine plugins and software to create a fingerprint of you online. This kind of device user fingerprinting is device or user specific, and the changing of a browser or software setting will only make your device more unique and identifiable. Google's decision on what tracking tool it expects to use in the place of cookies is expected to come in the coming weeks. Elise Hugh of NPR's All Tech Considered reported on Tuesday on a mystery that arose just after the Federal Reserve announced its decision on September 18th not to taper its bond buying program of capital injection into the U.S. economy. That news of the Fed's announcement took literally 7 milliseconds to reach Chicago. However, according to NPR and trading data analyzed by CNBC, some $600 million in assets changed hands on Chicago exchanges roughly 2 milliseconds, faster than the speed of light, before news of the Fed's decision reached Chicago. To put this in perspective, the exchange of $600 million in assets contrasted sharply with the very low volume of transactions that occurred before the Fed announcement in the Chicago exchanges. As NPR reported, the Federal Reserve is reportedly concerned and is in the process of questioning news organizations, as reporters get the Fed release early, but they get it in a secure room and are unable to communicate to the outside world until 2 p.m. on the dot. Speaking of someone who did once get these Fed releases early, and similarly was bound to the firm embargo in the offices of the House Finance Committee, the op-ed on this issue written by Neil Irwin of the Washington Post struck a chord this week. He writes, "In the high-frequency trading business, billions of dollars are spent on high-speed lines, programming talent, and advanced computers for funds looking to capitalize on the smallest and most fleeting mispricings. These computing resources and insanely intelligent people could be working to make the internet run faster for everyone, or figuring out how to deliver electricity more efficiently, or really anything other than trying to figure out how to trade gold futures on the latest Fed announcement faster than the speed of light. And I hope the Fed figures this one out." The online social media and networking site LinkedIn has always maintained that it gets full consent from its users before reaching out to any of their contacts. And the company reiterated this position in a statement on September 21st in response to a lawsuit filed in federal court in San Jose, California. 4 LinkedIn users have accused the site of accessing their email accounts without permission, harvesting the addresses of their contacts, and spamming those people with repeated invitations to join the service. In a blog post on the evening of Saturday, the 21st, LinkedIn went further, denying that it had ever broken into or hacked user accounts. Doug Mady, a spokesman for LinkedIn in Mountain View, California, said the lawsuit is without merit and the company will fight it. Although the claimants have not provided details on how the alleged hack or misuse of email might have occurred, the complainants appear to be among users who have synced their separate personal email accounts to LinkedIn in order to determine whether there may be other LinkedIn members among their colleagues whom they could add as contacts. The filing of the suit comes just 3 days after LinkedIn released its half-yearly transparency report, detailing that it had received 83 government requests for data over the 6-month period ending June 30th, 70 of which were from the U.S. government. However, because LinkedIn wants to break down the numbers into separate subpoena and search warrant baskets, it had to exclude national security-related requests from the report. LinkedIn Vice President Erica Rotenberg said that the ban was a source of great disappointment and frustration to the company, adding that LinkedIn strongly believes that all data, whether analog or digital, whether stored on personal computers or in the cloud, is subject to full Fourth Amendment protection under the Constitution. On September 18th of last week, the same day that Apple rolled out iTunes Radio, Pandora completed its first iPad app revamp since it debuted on the device in 2010. Pandora also updated its design and functionality to be in sync with the new release of iOS 7, which became available on September 20th. The branding and related refresh comes as Pandora scored a major legal victory last week against music publishers. In federal court in the Southern District of New York, Pandora got a ruling that affirmed its access to all of the songs covered in the ASCAP library. Pandora had argued that a consent decree with ASCAP had given it this blanket license, despite attempts by some publishers to divorce themselves from ASCAP and negotiate separate deals. The case arose when ASCAP members EMI, Sony ATV, and Universal Music Publishing each tried to remove their licensing rights from ASCAP and bypass a consent decree. The court ruled that they cannot do that. While the court's ruling means that Pandora has a right to play all music from artists represented by ASCAP, which currently has around 470,000 members, the court still has to address what, for ASCAP, is the bottom line issue of fair pay for singer and songwriter performance rights. And the trial is due to take place on these issues on December 4th. And here are some calendar items for your consideration for the coming week. On Tuesday, October 1st, the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs will have a hearing to examine government clearances and background checks, primarily in the wake of the Navy Yard tragedy in Washington, D.C. The hearings will begin at 2:15 p.m. in the Dirksen Senate Office Building. Also on Tuesday, October 1st, the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations will meet to consider a number of measures and the nomination of Caroline Kennedy of New York to be Ambassador of Japan. This hearing will begin at 2:30 p.m. and take place in the Hart Senate Office Building. On Wednesday, October 2nd, the Senate Committee on the Judiciary will meet to examine continued oversight of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, a hearing that will take place in the Dirksen Senate Office Building. In the EU, on Monday and Thursday of this week, the Civil Liberties Committee will hold its fourth and fifth in a series of hearings on issues dealing with U.S. surveillance in the EU. In the first session, members of the European Parliament will hear from whistleblowers formerly working in the NSA and at MI5. The second hearing will focus on alleged hacking by the UK's intelligence services of Belgian telecoms firm Belgicom. Representatives of British authorities and the Belgian Data Protection Supervisor will also take part in these discussions. Also during the week ahead, there will be plenary preparation for the members of the European Parliament. Political groups will prepare for the 7th through 10 October plenary session in Strasbourg, which will feature legislative votes on tobacco, shale gas, professional qualifications recognition, and the European Border Surveillance System. You have been listening to 40A&M N5, a production of 40A&M LLC. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's podcast were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from The Guardian, A Platform for Good.org, National Public Radio, The Atlantic Council, New York Times, and the BBC. Thank you for joining us again today, and we'll be back with you on Monday, October 7th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.